continuing the July 18th Vyasa Purnima discussion about Guru Tattva. And this is the continuation from part one, where we were reading from Harmonists about the role and relationship of Sri Guru, Lord Nityananda, and Lord Baladev. This is written in March of 1930. Sri Nityananda, the source of the preceptorial function, in other words, the source of the functioner role of Sri Guru. Sri Nityananda is identical with Sri Baladev, who is the alter ego of Sri Krishna, God Himself. Sri Nityananda or Baladev is different from, but conjoined with Sri Radhika. Sri Baladev is the connecting link between the secondary manifestations of Sri Krishna and corresponding manifestations of Sri Radhika. In other words, from Sri Baladev in Vaikuntha and Vrindavan, all the male personalities that serve Krishna expand. So his counterpart in this department is Srimati Radhika. And from Srimati Radhika, all the female servitors of the Lord expand from her. First the Kayavyuha Sakhi Mandris from her body, and then from them expand the Manishis of Dwarka, the queens, and from them expand the Devis of Vaikuntha, the Lakshmis, Lakshmi Sahasrasata Sam Brahmasevimana, thousands and millions of Lakshmi Devis and all the unlimited Vaikuntha planets, and from them expand the demigoddesses, Shachi Arundhati, Sachi Arundhati, Parvati, etc. Sri Baladev is the connecting link between all dissociable individual souls and the divine couple and their paraphernalia. In the activities of Sri Gaurasundar, Sri Nityananda is similarly the connecting link between the individual souls and Sri Gaurasundar, who is identical with Sri Radha Govinda. The separated individual souls serving the Supreme Lord with awe and reverence, which means Shanta Bhav or Dasya Bhav. In Vaikuntha, they worship Sri Baladev. The separated individual souls serve Nityananda when it is the wish of the Supreme Lord to augment the devotion of His servants by the chastening experience of separation from Himself. Averse souls have no access to the pastimes of Sri Krishna, but all individual souls have free access to Nityananda, although he is identical with Baladev. The eternal categorical distinction between the deluded condition and the state of grace of the individual's spirit soul is ignored by Sri Nityananda, but not by Sri Baladev. So, Nityananda, whether one's a conditioned soul or he's a liberated soul, he makes no distinction. Baladev, to have his service in Vaikuntha, or have his service, or to engage with him in the service of Lord Krishna in Braja Gokul, one has to be liberated. So Baladev can't entertain any, give any audience to the conditioned soul, but Nityananda does, like Jagai and Madai. So this difference makes Nityananda and not Baladev, although they are identical. This difference makes Nityananda the sole savior of all separated conditioned souls, those that are bound as well as those that are free. Free souls, or liberated souls, they recognize the greater mercy of Sri Nityananda, and this recognition is the basis of the possibility of their service to Sri Baladev. The Guru exercises or employs the delegated power of Sri Nityananda. In other words, the spiritual preceptor teaches the conditioned individual souls the direct service of Sri Nityananda. If a guru ignores Sri Nityananda, he is proven thereby to not possess the delegated power of Nityananda, by which alone any conditioned individual soul is allowed to discharge the spiritual duty of his position. The power of Nityananda alone is delegated to the succession of spiritual masters. I remember once after Prabhupada left this world, Srila Sridhar Maharaj, he said that your guru is Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. He was Nityananda Shakti. He was Nityananda Shakti. He was empowered Shakti of Nityananda. We sometimes say Shakti Avesh. Well, Shakti Avesh means invested with Shakti. Imbued with Shakti. But what kind of Shakti? Because Preetu was called Palya Shakti. He was imbued with Palya Shakti or Palana Shakti, which means nourishment, protection. Narada Muni is also Shakti Avesh Avatar, and he's called Bhakti Shakti. Bhakti Avatar, he's distributing devotion or bhakti all over the universe. So we say Shakti Avesh, so what kind of Shakti? Palana, Shristi, like Shiva, he's not a Jiva, he's not. In one form, Shiva's not Bhagavan, although he's Shiva Tattva. In one form, he is Vishnu Tattva, Sada Shiva. Sada Shiva is Vishnu Tattva. But the Shiva of this world, that does the destruction of the world, he's Shiva Tattva. But he's empowered with Pralaya Shakti, the power to destroy the universe. So we say that Srila Prabhupada's Shakti of Esh Avatar, that's not sufficient. Next question is, what Shakti? Shakti means power, potency, ability, capacity, empowerment. So it was told that Srila Prabhupada was invested with Nityananda Shakti. He departed a little bit from the standard of Archan established by his guru, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Without exception, except in Mamagachi and in Nalavik Mando, without exception, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, whenever he established mandirs or temples, he would establish Radha and Krishna, Radha Govinda, Gandharvika Giridhari, like this Radha Vinod or whatever. And then he would establish Sriman Mahaprabhu, one singular deity of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, because then they can share the same altar, you can stand on the same level, and even share the same altar with Radha and Krishna, because he's identical. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Radha Krishna Nahi Anya. Mahaprabhu is none other than Radha Madhav Yugo. He is Madhurya Tattva, Madhurya Mayi Purushottam, and Radha and Krishna Madhurya Mayi Purushottam. So he's the Audarya. Mahaprabhu is Rasaraj Sri Krishna and Mahabhav Radha in one unified form. So Mahaprabhu is the Audarya manifestation of Madhurya Radha and Krishna. Madhurya Radha and Krishna Yugo, when they become as one, and that oneness is distributed to the many, Eko Bahusham. And Radha and Krishna embrace in a loving, or combine in a loving embrace in Sringar Milan, divine union. And then that oneness, when that oneness, when they want to distribute themselves, the two become one, and they distribute themselves in the form of one, the golden avatar, the golden Lord Gauranga. He is actually Radha and Krishna combined. Bahir Radha Antar Krishna. Covered with Radharani's Kanti, but internally in his heart is Rasaraj Krishna, trying to relish the rasa of Radharani's Seva Ras, Radharani's Mahabhav. So everywhere in the 60 temples that Bhaktisiddhanta established, he has Mahaprabhu. Radha Madhava Mahaprabhu, Radha Govinda, Radha Govinda. Here at Radhakunda is one of the original temples established, original Gaudiya Math temples established by Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. He came here, established this temple in 1930-something. And the deities are Sri Radha Madhava and Sriman Mahaprabhu, you must have seen. There's no deity of Nityananda there, nor the other temples. Now Prabhupada, when he first started preaching, the Arshad Prabhupada, he followed very much exactly the example of his Guru Maharaj. His first campaign in preaching was in India, in a place called Jhansi, before his sannyas, he was Vanapras. And he brought one deity from Barakamba or Barampur, or whatever it is in Bengal. A beautiful deity of Mahaprabhu, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And he had that, he established the forerunner of ISKCON called the League of Devotees. It's a trust, the League of Devotees, for the purpose of translating and distributing books and doing puja and all these things that ISKCON eventually came to pass and execute. So the League of Devotees, that was their worshipful deity, one deity of Mahaprabhu. Then at one level, Prabhupada appeared to be not unsuccessful. So then he left that program and campaign and came to take shelter of Radha Vinod Bihari in Mathura at his godbrother's mandir, Jalila Sri Shripad Bhakti Pragyan Kesha Maharaj. He brought the deity with him of Mahaprabhu. And that deity is still there today on the altar in Mathura, Sri Kesha Ji Gaudiya. There are two deities of Mahaprabhu. One, I'm not sure which one, but one of them is Arch of the Prabhupada. So then Prabhupada, he started his preaching and first went to New York. And there he just had pictures of the Panchatattva in the Second Avenue. And gradually they got Radha and Krishna deities, Radha Govinda. And then later on sometime they got Varni Thayat on the line. When Prabhupada came back to India again, with ISKCON, he started preaching in Calcutta, his hometown. And he established a temple there, the name of the deities Radha Govinda. Because those are the names of his own childhood deities, Radha Govinda and the Muluk. Well, the family deities are Radha Govinda also. And Prabhupada's personal private deities are Radha Govinda. So he gave the deity's name in Calcutta, it's kind of Radha Govinda. And he installed a Mahaprabhu temple, a deity there. No Nityananda. And then from there, that office or that center, Prabhupada simultaneously developed Mayapur. And the first deity in Mayapur is Radha Madhava, small deity, Radha Madhava and Mahaprabhu. And they were being worshipped for a long, long time and finally a bunch of people being. So Prabhupada was following, to a large extent, the example of installing Mahaprabhu. But seeing the very fallen condition of the majority of the people, Prabhupada thought that Rasaraj Mahabhava is too esoteric and people won't be able to relate, understand in the beginning stages of the devotion. So then he invoked the mercy of Nityananda. He invoked the Shakti of Nityananda, the compassion, the determination, the humility, the enthusiasm to serve, and all the good qualities of Nityananda. So then everywhere Prabhupada was installing Gauranitai, Gauranitai, Gauranitai. So this is the point. Srila Prabhupada introduced the mercy of Nityananda. That's why Prabhupada was glorified as he was Nityananda Amsha. He was actually Nityananda Shakti. And Shakti Veshva, our Prabhupada carried a particular delegation of the Lord's power. He was carrying a particular delegation. And that delegation was Nityananda Shakti. The power to help the Jagais and Madais. Liberate and help all the Jagais and Madais in Russia and America and Europe and all these places. So he was Nityananda Shakti. Shakti Vesh, that type of Shakti. An individual soul may be entrusted with the delegated power of guru. Such delegated authority is not analogous with or identical with that of Sri Nityananda, because the wielder of delegated authority always remains absolutely faithful to the source of his power. The least deviation from perfect loyalty to the feet of Sri Nityananda results in automatic and complete withdrawal of the preceptorial authority from the offending individual soul. Disciple has thus a heavy responsibility in regard to the spiritual guide. The disciple must submit unconditionally to the guidance of the good preceptor or guru. He must not submit at all to the pseudo-preceptor. Those who do not wholly submit to the good preceptor are forced to submit to the limiting energy in the shape of the pseudo-preceptor, who may be an actual person, a lower animal, an inanimate object, or the concoction of the brain in the form of the passing whims of the individual. All this is submission to the limiting energy, or the submission to the material energy, Maya. All these types of things are submission to Maya. It takes possession of the soul who is averse to service of the good preceptor. The jiva soul cannot function at all in the environment provided. Cannot function at all, except the jiva soul can only function where the grace of Nityananda is provided, and only under Nitya's complete direction. The individual soul only has one freedom. What is that freedom? The freedom of choice between willing and unwilling acceptance of the guidance of Nityananda. You have the choice. Do you want to accept Nityananda's guidance or do you want to reject it? If someone is unwilling to submit to Nityananda, then he becomes deluded by the limiting energy of Nityananda to submit to himself, to herself. So the energy is female and the energetic is male. Radharani is female, Krishna is male. Shakti, Shaktiman. So if you submit to Nityananda, he's the Purusha principle. The male principle, Purusha Tattva. If you surrender to Mahamaya, that's Krishna's external energy, Maya. That which is not, that is female. Consider female. When the soul who is adverse to submitting himself to Nityananda and thus deluded by the strong laws of physical nature, then he foolishly regards himself as the master of his actions and considers himself to be a free agent. I do whatever I want to do. No one tells me what to do. I'm not in control of anybody, anything. This is their illusion. Although he is actually under the circumstances, he's unwilling to give up what he considers his birthright of freedom. Let's say in America, freedom is my birthright. He does not want to surrender, willfully enter an absolute submission to the feet of Nityananda. The freedom of choice to pursue the gratification of one's own sensuous desires is adopted as the guiding principle of a materialistic person's conduct. Supposedly, this activity in Maya, he considers it the pursuit of the truth. Those who are less intellectual, but equally disposed to seek their sense gratification, fall into the clutches of bewildered persons, passing themselves off as gurus. Some gurus say, well, you don't have to follow any principles. You can just enjoy. Many gurus like that. They say, I'll give you a mantra. What mantra do you want? What mantra do you want? Okay, you take that mantra, chant that mantra. Sometimes they initiate 10,000 people in the pandal. They raise up and say, how many? They say, they go like this. Maybe 50,000 people. So See, how many people want mantra for Saraswati mantra? So they can do well in your school and get good, pass your exams. People raise, and sorry, everyone else don't listen. And those people that want this mantra, you listen to this mantra over the PA system. Now I'll initiate everyone with this Saraswati mantra. Is everyone listening? One, two, three. I'm Saraswati Swaha. Let's repeat after me the new things. Okay, now you have Saraswati mantra, so you chant that and you become very learned. Then you can render service to our Swami Bhogananda Nakli Rascal mission. We're talking about where submission should be done. If we don't completely submit to the Guru, then we'll have to submit to Maya. We'll submit to something. We'll submit to a lower animal, an inanimate object, like a mental concoction, or whims of the individual. All this is different forms of submission to the limiting material energy. And such deluded submission takes possession of the soul who is averse to serving the spiritual master. Jiva can only function in an environment provided by Nityananda under his direction. So we talk about it, we only have the freedom of choice. When the soul is averse to submitting to Nityananda and thus deluded by the laws of physical nature, he thinks that he's a master of his activities and he's a free agent. Listen, I don't surrender to anybody. I don't submit myself to anybody. I do what I want. What is this servile mentality? Surrender to some man. What is this guru? Just a man like you. He eats, he sleeps, he passes too. Why do you surrender? You don't need any guru. You just read a Gita on your own. You know, you're a Brahmin and a Brahmin family. Why do you need guru? You can do your college and you don't need the universe. Prakriti kriyamanani gunani karmani sarvasha ahankar iti yama. No, ahankar vimudatma. Ahankar vimudatma kartam iti manyate. Prakriti kriyamani guni karmani sarvasha. Because of all the modes of nature and material energy, one gets covered, a little bewildered and confused, and due to false ego and misplaced identity, he starts acting very foolish. Ahankara vimudatma. Vishesh mudha means a very special category of ass. Two-legged ass with a mustache. Two-legged ass with a mustache. He says, he starts braying all kinds of nonsense. You don't need guru. You're a guru, we're all guru. But even that, preaching that means you become guru. Right? You're preaching to people. No one needs a guru. Guru's within you. Just follow the guru within you. Then, but what about, what are you trying to do? You're acting like a guru. You tell me I don't need a guru. And the guru's within you, so just be quiet. I don't need you to tell me anything. You're a hypocrite. Such a deluded soul is unwilling to give up what he considers his birthright to freedom. He says, I'm free. Why should I submit myself absolutely at the feet of Nityananda? The freedom of choice to pursue sense gratification becomes the guiding principle of his conduct. So he wants to have the freedom. The conditioned soul wants to maintain his freedom. He does not want to submit to Guru or Nityananda, whom the Guru is representing. He says, I want my freedom. So basically, what is his freedom? His freedom is just keeping his choices open. He wants the freedom of choice to enjoy his senses, rather than choosing to submit to Guru and becoming slave of Krishna or slave of Guru. He becomes a slave of his senses. He wants the freedom to be a slave of his senses. I have my freedom. It's my birthright. From birth, I have this right, this freedom to choose. So I choose. Why should I serve Guru, surrender to Guru? I use my freedom of choice. I'm choosing to serve my senses. My senses are dictating to enjoy this and enjoy that. So this becomes the guiding. This is the guiding principle of my conduct. The guiding principle of my behavior, conduct, is not to submit to Guru and do whatever he says, not to submit to Krishna and Guru and try to please them with all my body, mind, and words. Kaya Manavakya. That is the guiding principle of a surrendered soul. The Sharanagata. Sharanagata Jeev. One is surrendered soul. His guiding principle of his life is how to surrender at every moment to Guru and Krishna, and dedicating all his energy and activity to giving pleasure to Guru and Krishna. That's the guiding principle. But the non-devotee, he's also made a choice. The devotee's exercise is free will, his free choice. He's chosen that, yes, I want to surrender to Krishna. Yes, I want to serve the one I'm surrendered to, Krishna and Guru. So that's his exercise of his free will and his free choice. And a materialist, conditioned soul, a maya body, one whose body is in maya, he also has freedom of choice, so he also makes a choice, like the devotee. But he chooses not to serve Krishna, and not to serve Guru, and not to surrender to Krishna, and not to surrender to Guru. He chooses, I maintain my freedom, and I make the choice to serve my senses. This is my choice, to pursue the gratification of my own senses. So you are choosing to become Krishna's slave. You are choosing to become Guru's slave, Guru Kinkar. Guru Kinkar, Bhagavan Kinkar, Krishna Kinkar. That means Nanda Kinkar means a slave. Kinkar means slave, unpaid servant, a slave of the master. Hai Nanda Tanasha Kinkaram, Patitam Bham Shabeva Mamado, Kripyata Paramakaja, Stita Duli Sadhisham Vijandhya. Oh, I'm a slave, just keep me on your foot somewhere. If I have any connection with your foot dust, I'll be successful. Charna Duli, Charna Raj. That's all I want. That's the only payment I want. This little dust from your feet on my head. That is the only payment I desire. So the conduct, the principle of the conduct is quite different. So the conditioned soul who exercises his choice in this way, he thinks that this is the pursuit of truth. As much as it appeals to his perverted taste of his atheistic nature. But there are other people that aren't so intellectual, but they're also equally desirous of enjoying their senses. So they fall into the clutches of deluded persons posing themselves as guru. The responsibility for choosing the pseudo-guru belongs wholly to the disciple. So in other words, these neophytes, disciples, they aren't aware of Shastra. They have no idea of Shastra. So then they somehow end up with a very unqualified guru. And such a guru will not be very much interested in having his disciples read Shastra. It's interesting, there's many people today, without mentioning any names, very prominent so-called gurus, they advise, they teach or order, request their disciples, don't waste time studying these ancient Shastras. There's no value there. You hear my teachings and you follow my sadhana, my art of living course, the art of living. You don't need any Shastra, because my teachings are sufficient. We don't have time. We're very busy now with our work, with our families. There's a heyday of life, a hectic everyday life. There's no time for us to go through the Shrutis or Smritis. What to speak, even the Puranas, we have no time to read. Mahabharata is too big, Ramayana is too big. And the Puranas, there's 18 Puranas. It's only Upanishads. We don't have any time. So my teachings, my few books that I have, you can read those. And that's sufficient. And so these pseudo-gurus, they discourage their followers from reading any Shastra. Why? Because if they read the scriptures, they will see that there are directions for choosing a proper guru. There's Shishya-lakshana and Guru-lakshana. What are the characteristics of a proper student? What are the characteristics of a proper guru? What is his behavior? Well, how does he behave? Does he follow any principles? And usually these pseudo groups, these modern groups, there's no principles. Oh, we have four relative principles in our society. Oh, really? Our guru doesn't make any implementation. That's not. See, our guru teaches Raga Bhakti. Our guru is teaching Raghunuga Bhakti. So it's just Raga, just Radha and Krishna, your attachment, just the Prem Bhav, just the flow of your Prem Bhav, just Bhav. This is all mechanical, all these rules and regulations, yama niyam, get up early, and no one is in garlic, all these restrictions and all these rules. It's no, you can't have any Bhav there, you can't have any flow of Bhav. You can't really express yourself if you're bound and limited by all these rules and regulations. Get up early and eat sattvic food and offer your food. It's only rituals. It's just empty. It's meaningless. It's all mechanical things. Just be what you are and just sing about Radha and Krishna and just remember them and think of them and just do everything for them. Forget about all these things. That's how they preach. Choosing a guru means that we use our judgment based on Shastra. Of course, in the beginning, due to insufficient judgment or experience or understanding, one may surrender to a bogus guru. But when we submit to a good preceptor, then we get, that is actually our good fortune, and that's the exercise of real freedom. So the conclusion is that in the spiritual communion between the good preceptor or qualified guru and qualified disciple, there should be no ignorance there, no samshaya, no doubts, no ignorance, no delusion. Everything should be clear, clear understanding, clear path, clear means of communication. A sadguru should not be confused with a bogus guru. So the conclusion of this article is that we should exercise our judgment at every step of our spiritual progress. It is only the pseudo-preceptor and his willing victims whose mutual selfish interests are opposed to any searching examination of our spiritual requirements. So a false guru will tell his would-be candidates for initiation or the new recruits. He would tell them, oh, there's no reason to study Shastra. You don't have to do an examination. So it's mutual. So the disciples may have selfish interests. They may think, if I'm connected with this famous guru, I'll get fame by that connection, or maybe I'll get position or money. If I say so-and-so, Dayalu, or whatever Lu, Laglu, or this one, Lalu, Laglu, Dayalu. He's my guru, so I may get some promotion in life, or I may get some post or position. It may help me in the society. So he's already a little bit cheating, the disciples calculating some material benefit. But then he made a guru that will encourage him to stay in ignorance. There's no need to do anything more. So this is some interesting points here in this particular article about the guru and Nityananda, representing Nityananda, and then it concluded with about the qualifications. One should be a little bit intelligent and exercise proper judgment in choosing guru. So this particular entry is about our duty to the real Acharya. This is quite an interesting article. It's by Kirtanananda, the Brahmacharya, February 1929. He says, as truly said in the Bhagavatam, to know the truth, the absolute truth, one must serve and worship the holy feet of the real and true master, Sadguru. Then what does it mean to worship the Guru? To truly worship the Guru's holy feet, one must be near to them. And to be near is to transcend mundane existence or Maya. This condition is absolutely indispensable, but most difficult for fulfillment of the fallen souls. For the real master ever lives by the inscrutable will and power of personal Godhead in the transcendental region of eternal existence, knowledge, and bliss. Although, in other words, Sri Guru is always living with Krishna and sat down. But Sri Guru simultaneously, he seems or appears in our materialized perception to live and move in this phenomenal world of ours as a mortal man in a material form. This is due to the misfortune of fallen souls embodied in matter, when their spiritual form with spiritual senses lies hidden by their finer and grosser material forms. As they transcend matter and discover their spiritual eternal forms, their true perception and right worship of the true master with their spiritual senses, and through him that of God, begins. People in their fallen and ignorant state cannot properly understand and realize this transcendental character of the Vaishnavacharya, who is the nearest and dearest constant servant of the Supreme Absolute Lord Sri Krishna, the personal Godhead, and his messenger, preacher, and Messiah in this world for all time. Does not then the worship of people bound by Maya reach the holy feet of the Sadguru? In other words, when people or conditioned souls are worshipping the Guru, does their worship reach the Guru? Or the Guru is so far away in the Paravyoma and the spiritual world that the worship goes nowhere? Yes, surely there is hope for the conditioned soul, and that is a most encouraging one, because that Sadguru comes down before them, and with his unbounded mercy, he accepts their worship, however low and imperfect. And by his most gracious acceptance, he purifies the worshiper and makes his worship perfect. Complete renunciation is a most difficult and inconceivable practice to most people. In spiritual matters, most people are very ignorant. With their empirical wisdom, the ordinary person, he reasons that such surrender is nothing but foolish slavery and therefore self-strangulation. It's about strangling yourself. In other words, to surrender completely and unequivocally at the feet of the Sadguru, this is preposterous. This is like slavery. For someone to submit to the absolute mercy and control of a guru, another human being, simply blocks all freedom and hampers the forward progress of a man. Because if you surrender to a guru who seems to be just an ordinary mortal man, then your own progress in life comes to a standstill. You can't make any progress anymore in such a debilitated position. Such surrender is the lowest depth of degradation and is nothing short of a living death. This is what the conditioned souls think about surrender to Guru. Guru Parashraya, this is the threshold of bhakti, surrendering to Guru. Ah, the illusion of Maya. Ah, the darkness of ignorance. Here lies the crux of the whole thing. Here is the question to live or die. This is how Maya, or ignorance, wages her eternal war against transcendental knowledge. Nice article. But the Messiah of harmony, Prophet, Savior, The Messiah of harmony, the Sadguru, always comes down when the world needs him most. And he always comes down in the hour of its extreme need to save, to lift, and to redeem the fallen people from the clutches of ignorance. And to announce emphatically once again the word of God, the message of the eternal absolute truth. What does the Guru say? How does he speak? He says, by themselves, my dear fellow men, the elusive power of Maya, the illusory energy of Godhead, is insurmountable. Daiviyeshu gunamayi mama maya duratyaya mama ilaye prapadyante mayame tam tarantite, Krishna says in 7th chapter of Gita, verse 14. What is it? Daiviyeshu gunamayi mama maya duratyaya. This Maya, this is mama maya. This Mayak energy, this Mahamaya is my energy, is mine. You can defeat God, you can defeat me? No, you can't defeat my energy either. Impossible. On your own, with your own wisdom, with your own strength, with your own beauty, power, money, position, influence. Impossible. Many have tried, all have failed. History tells the story of the foolish attempts to conquer God and to conquer nature. No one wins and everyone gets defeated. But there is one exceptional personality that captures the crown and wins the race. And he is the one that surrenders to me. I am, he says, the one who becomes my prapadyante, he surrenders to me, becomes my slave. Mayam etam tarantite. Taranti means tarani, means he gets liberated, he gets free, crosses over this vast ocean. I pick him up and carry him to the other side of birth and death. This is my promise. This is my guarantee. Only when one takes shelter in the eternal and transcendental feet of God can they overcome the illusory energy. That the question of submitting or not to an acharya that confronts a man is but the acid test put by Maya to test the sincerity of the man under her control who wants to free himself from her bondage and then return back to his eternal home and to live the eternal life of unalloyed bliss. Submission to a guru or acharya is not suicide. But what is it? It means to live a true and eternal life, free from all misery, full of permanent, ever-increasing, transcendental joy and service. Sevananda. Nitya Sevananda. Without submission to the transcendental light and guide of Guru, and without Guru's help, how can one dispel the gloom and travel the way home? Even in this finite material world, within the reach of their senses, people can hardly learn anything without the help, without any help of some sort or from another. And yet, how much little do they actually know this vast material nature? To think and say that one can make his way independently of any extraneous help from matter to spirit, from this finite mortal to the infinite immortal region, beyond the range of the material senses, and he can know and perceive Godhead, is preposterous and sheer arrogance. Because I don't need anybody, I'll do it myself, I don't need anything, I can realize God, why do I need a guru? God's in my heart, God's in everyone's heart. This foolish independence, a foolish self-confidence. We don't need anybody's help. The analogy he's giving is that we can't even pass our time in this material world without help from outside of our, without outside help. Animals, nature, friends, people, bosses, family. We need so much help at every step along the way to make our progress in material life. or to speak about the immortal truth. Only an exceptionally fortunate person realizes the need to take initiation from a Sadguru, and such a person will believe in the sublime spiritual character of the Guru. So this type of fortune is very rare to find. Someone who's very, has a basic inherent piety and religiousness, he will come to this position of finding Guru. The Guru comes down to free the world from the all-devouring mouth of atheism, which is nothing but a trap, a beautiful trap, temptingly spread out by Maya to catch the unwary and the pseudo-theistic masters and servants. The Guru declares and preaches with great emphasis and boldness that theism proper consists of the belief in the absolute supremacy of Krishna, the concrete personal absolute Godhead, his eternal and spiritual name, form, qualities, and pastimes. All of these are identical, eternal, and transcendental. Who is the trusted representative of God on the earth? It must be a living faith, inspiring and molding the whole life and all the actions of the believer. So the Guru is the embodiment of Shraddha. Shraddha Vigraha, Kripa Shakti Murti. Kripa Shakti Murti is a form of mercy. He's also a Shraddha, Shraddha Murti. Shraddha Shakti. Shraddha is also a Shakti. Kripa is a Shakti. Vidya is a Shakti. So he's the embodiment of living faith, inspiring and molding the whole life and all the actions of the disciple. Anyone falling short of this standard in any degree will be a mixed thing and no true belief. To be a master and to enjoy the world, to be served and not to serve, in whatever way it may be, is atheism, pure and simple. So what is atheism? It means to enjoy the world. What is atheism? To be the master. What is atheism? To receive service and never render service. That's atheism. To serve and not to be served, this is the very constitution of the jiva. This is very hard to understand, because we haven't been in our constitutional nature for a few billion years. We've been extracting service from the environment. We've been forcing the environment to serve us, willingly or unwillingly. Nature, people, animals, we're extracting service, forcing them, compelling them, making the beasts into domestic animals, making the single woman into our lawful wedded wife, quote-unquote slave. So in this way, we've been engaging the environment in our service. I, me, mine. I am the center, everything for me. But the fact is, to serve and not to be served is the very constitution of a jiva. And it is when he forgets his real nature that he proceeds to usurp or take over or assume the function of a proprietor and enjoyer of the world. And then he becomes a master of the world, or he plays the role of Lord Krishna and tries to enjoy the world by means of his senses in all possible ways. I remember our Gavala used to say, don't try to put your face on Krishna's. Krishna is the supreme enjoyer, creator, controller. And then you say, oh, why should he enjoy? I should also enjoy. I should also create and control. So we put our face on Krishna's, try to, like Pondraka. But the world as well as he is in substance God has possessions or properties, and a possession or property of His has certainly no right to claim and enjoy it as His own. In other words, the world belongs to God, and everything here is His property. So how can we say it's our property? And yet, enjoyment is not His lot. In His fancied enjoyment, the conditioned soul only becomes a completely bound slave of the world of Maya. The more one strives after lordship and enjoyment, the deeper and worse becomes his bond of servitude. But alas, no amount of reasoning and admonition will deter the poor jiva from the wrong path. For his perversion and ignorance clouds his vision. A seeker of the absolute truth has another great barrier to encounter. If by good fortune, by the grace of the Lord, the supreme necessity of a true guide to the kingdom of Godhead, the realm of the absolute, is understood, the next barrier is where and how to find the Guru. First barrier is, what is the first barrier? First barrier is, I'm not surrendering to anybody. I'm not going to bow down to anybody. I don't need anybody to realize God. I'm not going to become anybody's slave. I'm not going to become anybody's servant. That's the first barrier, which is an indication of complete ignorance. But one understands, wait a minute, actually, everyone's a servant. God is the Supreme Master. And to actually know God is a science, and you need a teacher. So I think I need a guru, I think I need a guide. So then you overcome the first barrier. Some submission comes. The idea of submission, and the will to submit. But then the next barrier comes, well, who to submit to? Where to submit? Where is the teacher, guru? There is no dearth or lack of pseudo-gurus in the world, particularly in India, the land of Dharma or truth, where the noblest office of the guru, which is at the same time the highest service of the absolute Godhead and benevolence to all beings, that office of the guru has been abused to the extreme and exploited for mean, selfish ends by imposters and ungodly persons. Intelligent people have seen through the game and lost all faith in the institution of guru. At this crisis, the real guru comes down to rescue people from this distrust and to open their eyes to the true characteristics of a real guru, and thereby to kindle their dormant faith in him. That's called the pessimists. People become pessimists. Optimists and pessimists. They have some experience in the world. Oh, I had this guru, but he cheated me. He took all my money and this, that. And so, and then I went to another guru, but then I found that he was no good and this, that. All these gurus are all bogus. Sometimes people say like that. Meet some old guy or something. A lot of these gurus are all, they're all cheaters, they're all bogus. They just want something. They just want to live off their disciples. They're lazy men. Lazy, they just want to eat Mahaprasad and ring a bell. I get some little young kids to ring the bells and cook. And they just eat the Mahaprasad, sit in front of the AC, watch the TV. And with big beard and flowing saffron robes. But the real guru teaches and preaches. He also demonstrates practically by his own behavior that he is in fact the truest and dearest servant of God. The guru, true guru, faithfully acts up to what he preaches. In other words, he's not a hypocrite. The guru thinks, speaks, and acts in terms of pure, unalloyed, theistic service to the absolute Godhead only. The guru breathes devotion and service. His very life is an animated example of the all-round ideal and perfect service of the Supreme Godhead. For every moment of his life, here and thereafter. Such service to Godhead presupposes that the Guru has already attained true and perfect knowledge of the personal Godhead and become aware of the Lord's constant presence before him. Therefore, the Guru is well conversant. In other words, he's Tattva Darshan, Dhyaninas Tattva Darshan. He's seen the truth. He knows the truth clearly, personally, individually. The Guru is well conversant with the Absolute Godhead. The real Guru is well conversant with God and his teachings, and he's quite competent to remove the darkness of ignorance and all doubts from the sincere seeker. And he's capable of carrying the disciple along to the holy feet of the Absolute Godhead, alias Sri Krishna. The Guru admits, acknowledges, and honors the supremacy and authority of Godhead. He believes fully in the Vedas, which is the legacy of transcendental knowledge of God, originally emanating from God Himself, which has been preserved perfectly and uninterruptedly through a long, unbroken chain of accredited gurus or acharyas from time immemorial down to the present day. The Sadguru is truly an embodiment of the correct traditional knowledge of all Siddhantas or principles. But now the seeker's long chain of obstacles do not end here. The first obstacle is not believing in anyone knows the truth or anyone has seen the truth and not wanting to surrender to anyone. And the second obstacle or hurdle is that you realize the need for Guru, then you find Guru, then you surrender to Guru, or at least you find one that has the qualifications of Guru. Now, there's some more obstacles. It has been truly observed, quote, the path of true devotion towards the unalloyed service of Krishna is beset with millions of thorns. Now one is submitted to Guru and taken initiation. Now he enters the vast intermediate zone. The vast intermediate zone. The ocean of anarthas.
How do you go?
The ocean of Aparad. Many, many waves. Many, many miles and miles of vast, uncharted, shark-infested waters. It is said only in the fitness of a thing. For we all know that a precious treasure is most cautiously guarded. Maya, the elusive power of the Absolute Godhead, and his ignored maidservant, that is, his lower energy, zealously protects the path of true devotion against casual intruders. Are you a casual intruder?
Yes.
Are you a serious walker? Are you a serious seeker on the path of truth? Or are you just
casual
intruder? Those who are actually averse to the selfless service of God, although Maya Devi is ever ready to help an earnest and sincere servant of her master, Lord Krishna. But on the contrary, she will thrash out even the least and last of all impurities, such as the selfish desires of the fallen lying concealed or disguised in the innermost recesses of one's mind, which are escaping all human detection.
Amazing.
She will find out what you've got inside. She can say, Hari Bo, Prabhu, nice to see you, you're nice to see you, you're nice to see you, Prabhu. You come to Mangalarti every day. We chat your rounds every day. You read the Bhagavad Gita. You're very nice. And Maya says, you're fake. You cheat. You lumpat. You kapat. Lumpat. Kapat. I see everything. Clear as a bell. So I'm going to cut you to the quick.
Da!
Take that.
That bomb. Tom.
However, The ever kind-hearted Acharya moves in, seeing the plight of the conditioned soul, and he goes out personally to redeem and lift up all the suffering souls without any consideration of their rank, color, caste, creed, sex. With this end in view, the guru, or the acharya, sends out different preachers in different directions, where these preachers are his trusted followers. They go door to door to deliver to all ears, willing or unwilling, by entreaties and persuasions, the message of the great Lord, Sri Chaitanya Dev. They tell the people that all manifestations, animate and inanimate, within this world, are in essence eternal servants. They are possessions or properties of the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna, and they belong to his eternal kingdom. And they should engage in sincere, eternal service of God and uninterrupted singing of his transcendental name, Hare Krishna Ram. They're all identified with this person or form. This is the only and eternal function of every soul. And herein lies the source of eternal good and happiness. This is the message of the preachers of Mahaprabhu. However, when this message becomes forgotten and it loses its import, and it becomes darkened with the filth of abuses, at that time the Sadguru descends to purge the philosophy of all impurities and reinstate it in its true color and eternal glory, preaching the true and eternal religion of love and harmony, and to establish it under many preaching centers for missionary activities at different places on the globe. Very interesting descriptions of the activities. It seems like the author is glorifying his own guru, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. The guru invites one and all and gives them an opportunity to hear inspiring and animating philosophical discourses, religious, patriotic, and philosophical. He invites everyone to chant and sing uninterruptedly Harinam and to listen to the same. He invites everyone to take Mahaprasad. To do this, to accomplish these works, he brings out publications of religious and scriptural books and broadcasts the message of peace and harmony, devotion, and service to the Supreme Personal Godhead in as many languages as possible. Therefore, he gives ample opportunities to everyone at large, all over the world, to hear, sing, and realize Godhead. In short, all of the Acharya's energies and efforts are constantly and solely directed towards rendering real, undying, and non-evil producing service to humanity. This article from The Harmonist appeared in December 1929. It's talking about Guru Seva, the need to and the benefit of serving the spiritual master. This article was penned by one disciple, Professor Ghosh, and a master's MA and BL, whatever that is. Obviously educated person. All the scriptures, Shrutis, Smritis, Puranas, they sing about the glories of serving the Acharya, the true preceptor. Out of infinite mercy for the poor creatures of the world in bondage, the Acharya appears in this world to accept their service. For the service of the true preceptor is really the only means for bound living entities to get free from Maya and regain the service of God, which is the very essence of real life, the life of every individual jiva. The scriptures declare the Acharya is a counterpart of Godhead, Ashraya Jatiya. He's in a class of the Ashraya, the shelter, is part, an aspect of Godhead that gives shelter. We say Guru Parashraya, Ashraya Vigraha. The Guru is called Ashraya Vigraha. He's a form of shelter. By taking shelter of Guru, then we attain Krishna's shelter. So that's how he represents divinity. The Acharya descends to the mundane plane in the form of the perfect servant of Godhead, with the mission of liberating the conditioned souls and re-establishing their absolute freedom in the blissful transcendental home and the eternal service of Godhead. When the jiva engages in the continual service of the Guru, all the ignorance and attachments in his mind disappear. The mirror of his heart becomes purged of all dross, which means unwanted things. And then only in his chaste and purified heart dawns spontaneously knowledge of God, which brings him the highest good. But strangely enough, a jiva can never come in contact with a good guru as long as his desires for sense gratification remain strong. When one has become thoroughly disgusted with material enjoyment, then he should approach a guru with a mood of service. The Shrutis say that the true purport of the Vedas is revealed to one who has complete faith in Guru and God. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna's Kaviraj says, as one serves Krishna and Guru, the bondage of Maya goes away. One attains the lotus feet of Krishna. In other words, the conclusion is that under the guidance of the Guru, by serving him, this is the way we will attain Godhead. He talks a lot about pseudo-gurus. Apparently there are a lot of pseudo-gurus in the 20s. 1928. The relationship of the preceptor and the disciple is successful to the degree in which the disciple surrenders to the qualified guru. And just a long story about Ramanuja had some disciples. And then there's some tests about those disciples. Yogyesh and Lakshmi Devi, one wife and one Brahmin. How sincere they were.
Was that Gopin story?
Yeah, somehow they reached his cottage as Brahmin Bharata, and he wasn't there. And they only had one gamsha, and her husband was wearing it. So these sannyasis came to her house, and she had to receive them. So she couldn't really. It was her guru actually came, I guess Ramanuja. Yeah, Ramanuja came. And she had some old cloth, and she couldn't come before a guru in a dirty cloth, so she found some rag. It was all torn into pieces, and she washed it and dried it in the sun. And she. You know, she was bathing at that time, and she was waiting for her husband to come back so she could get the gumshoe from him. She was nude, so she found a rag that was torn into pieces. It was drying in the sun. And so she threw that, covered herself with that. But she was not able to come forward. So she tried to indicate to her guests, her guru, and others that she couldn't come and pay obeisances with a clap of the hand from inside her room. She didn't come out to the outer room. So at this, Ramanuja threw his chatter into her room. Then his disciple Lakshmi covered herself and came before a guru and made obeisances. And she said, "My master, please take your seat. My husband has gone out for begging, but now I'll prepare offerings for Vishnu." But there was not a grain of rice in the hut. She was already aware of this when she offered hospitality. But now she could not think out any means. She didn't have anything to offer them. She said, "Please sit down, I'll make some food for you." But one thing was clear in her mind, it was her actual duty to entertain the guests. This is, of course, what guests are supposed to do. We're all Vaishnavas, specifically her guru and his disciples. And she was willing to perform this duty of serving the Vaishnavas, even if she had to give up her life. Nevertheless, in this helpless mood, she started praying to Narayan. There was no way out, no means, no food, no way. Acha. There was a very rich, merchant who was a very wealthy man, lived quite nearby. And he always was captivated by the beauty of this Brahmini named Lakshmi. He made a few passes at her many times before, and she rebuked him and ran away. And he had promised her many times to give money if she would satisfy him, pay him off. But she's a chaste wife, and she was above all temptations and seductions. But today she thought, this is a unique opportunity to utilize to the best, most transient beauty of flesh, which ends up becoming a feast for dogs and jackals. So in her mind she thought, she argued this in her mind. We're so fortunate today that the Vaishnavas and my Guru himself have come to my house to receive hospitality. I have an opportunity to render Vaishnava Seva, Hari Guru Vaishnava. Serve the Guru and the Vaishnavas all in one place. I'm already serving Hari. Now the Vaishnavas and Guru have come. It's my fortune to have an opportunity to serve them. My misfortune is I have nothing. No food to offer them. And all the scriptures attain that such service is rarely attained. And by serving the Vaishnavas and Guru, one can attain all perfection in life. And she's thinking all these things. She's thinking, well, anyway, what if I offer my body to the rich man? He gives me money, then I can cook some grains and cook and serve the Vaishnavas. I may go to hell for my immoral act, but at least I'll get the benefit in my account for serving Guru and Vaishnavas. And then she's thinking that actually the scriptures say that the desire to gratify one's own senses is lust. But if you desire to glorify the senses of God and His devotees, that is divine love. I will not commit sin if I do this activity, I may go to hell, it may lead me to hell, but at least I'll get an opportunity to serve the Guru and the Vaishnavas. So then at once she went to the house of the rich man, and she told him that I will fulfill your desire, you just give me something in advance. So she came to this resolve, and she informed him to his great joy and surprise or her decision to satisfy that night his long-standing desire. And no sooner did Lakshmi Devi, this lady named Lakshmi Devi, intimate her immediate need for all necessary things required for serving her guests. So then that merchant sent all kinds of food and dishes to her house. And she prepared that prasad, and she fed her saintly guests sumptuously. So the poor lady who promised to give her body to the lusty neighbor, she got the foodstuffs from him and prepared it and fed her Guru Ramanuja and his disciples, and he was very happy. It was a nice prasad, and he gave her blessing, but she looked a little morose and sad. And Ramanuja inquired, "What is the source of your distress, my disciple?" And she said, she was hesitant she kept saying, "No, nothing's wrong. She was quite hesitant to reveal her mind to her Gurudev. And he said, "Actually, I understand. This man is waiting for me. This is my problem." So Ramanuja said, "No problem. You just take my Mahaprasad, my remnants from this meal, and you give that to you give this to your lusty neighbor merchant, and you tell him we had some homa in our house, some puja, and this is some prasad, and I want to give you this prasad." Yeah, he was really excited when she came with the offering of a plate of Mahaprasad. It increased his attachment and attraction to her, that she's so submissive and affectionate, she wants to feed me and make me happy. As soon as this lusty merchant took one bite of Ramanuja's Mahaprasad, his Param Vaishnava Chishta, then he had some immediate transformation of his mind and heart. He became overwhelmed, and then some strange feeling was coming over him. And clearly a wave of purification entered his heart and mind, and he said to the lady Lakshmi Devi, he said, "I don't know what's happening, but I've just taken one bite of this prasada and my whole mind is changing in my viewpoint, and I can't see you as anyone else but Mataji. You seem like you're my mother. So I've been waiting in anticipation for this meeting with you, and I've been dreaming all kinds of different pleasures and enjoyments that we would pass together. And then when you came, and as soon as you gave me this bite of this food, all those schemes and plans and dreams and hopes are just evaporated, and I'm a whole new person. So I'm a little bit, something strange going on. What what has happened? What is this prasadam? What did you put in this prasadam? Where does it come from? So then this Lakshmi Devi, this Brahmani lady, disciple Ramanuja, she explained that this is the remnants of my guru, Ramanuja Jarja. And then she went on to glorify and tell all the wonderful glories of her guru. And then he got inspired and said, well, where is your guru? And said, well, he's resting in my house after feeding him, or he's nearby or whatever. So then he said, oh, I want to go see him. He became inspired. So Lakshmi Devi, this disciple, female disciple, took this lusty merchant to meet Ramanuja. Then he met and became so impressed by the guru Prabhav, by the influence of the pure bhakti of Ramanuja and the divine presence, that he fell at Ramanuja's feet and begged forgiveness for his heinous offense against his chaste lady, who was his disciple, and begged him to please accept him in his service and grant him initiation. So Ramanuja agreed and initiated him. And that story is here. So this is being mentioned here in this offering about the power of the guru. The guru is so powerful that his will to help people and benefit people is unlimited, and also the power of a disciple. If a disciple tries to always follow the Shastra and always be protected somehow or other. So the disciple wants to please the guru, even willing to apparently go against dharma or go against morality. So there's different principles working here. Principle of morality, the principle of Patni Dharma, Vihasta Dharma. There's all different kinds of Dharma. Social Dharma, the rules and codes of society, Patni Dharma, Loka Dharma, Sri Dharma, Sati Dharma. But Krishna tells in Bhagavad Gita, Sarva Dharma Pritya Mamekam Sharanam Braja, that all dharmas can be abandoned for the service of Krishna and Guru. Guru Seva is equal to Krishna Seva. Guru and Krishna are one. Acharya Imam Vijaniyam Namamani Tikarichi. Krishna tells 11th Canto of Bhagavatam, I am the Acharya is me. The service of Guru is prophylactic, perfect, and pure, just like service of Krishna. So in the service of Guru, there's no morality. There's no consideration but the pleasure having some Guru and Krishna. This is a case where she was acting immorally, irreligiously, sinfully. A married woman commits adultery, which is what we're talking about. She can be murdered. And the example, I don't know what age, well, of course this was Kali Yuga, but she can be murdered for that activity of adultery in Kali Yuga if she does that activity. In Treta Yuga, which is prior, I mean there's two, Kali Yuga, then Dwapara Yuga, and Treta Yuga. In Treta Yuga, if a man or a woman, usually we would think a man, I mean a woman for some reason, but if a woman even thinks about adultery with a man, she's killed. An example is the 9th canto of Bhagavatam, Renuka and Jamadagni. Jamadagni was the father of Parasarama and 5 other sons, or maybe 6 other sons. And his wife, Renuka, they were living in a hermitage in the forest, even like Rajarishi, a great saint and rishi, unmarried of course, like a progenitor type. And Renuka went to get some water, and in a lake there in the forest there were some demigods, Gandharvas I suppose, and they were enjoying an intimate man-woman relations. And the demigods were very beautiful and handsome and fragrant, bodies fragrant like lotus flowers naturally, and very effulgent and attractive, all features very attractive. And she looked after the Gandharva man and she became lusty. She said, I would like to enjoy. And of course this is a breach of chastity. And in the Treta Yuga you would get reaction for your thoughts. If you sin in your mind, you get punished. So she came back and the husband, Jamadagni, can read the past, present, future. Can easy, actually. To be able to read people's minds is not very difficult. It's not even listed as one of the cities. There's Ashta cities. Anima city, Lagima city, Mahima, Lagima, Anima, Prapti city, Kamavasyata, and Prapti city. Many different cities are there. Reading minds is like small time. It doesn't even count. These mystic cities are really significant. Become so small, decrease your body size so you can go through a keyhole. There's a little hole in the door. You can go through the keyhole, come out the other side, and blow yourself up and steal all the jewelry or whatever and throw it out the window and then go out the keyhole and go out and pick it up. Whatever. There's anima city. So reading people's minds is not difficult, especially for a rishi or sage. So when Renika came back in Jamadagni, he said, "So you've broken your vow, sati vow. You're no longer chaste. You're no longer my wife." And the reaction for the sin of adultery is murder, killing. So he ordered the sons, "Kill your mother." And they said, "Dad, it's a little hard to do." Yeah. So they, of course, the father is the guru for the children and the wife. So, and he was following Shastra, and he was correct. He was not just fanatic, madman, chauvinist. He said, "Kill your mother." They said, "Father, we can't do that." So then Parasram was out hunting or whatever. He was out somewhere. He came back and he said, "Parasram, I want you to kill your mother and your brothers. Because they just, your mother's an adulteress, and so she should be murdered, and your brothers are Guru Avagya. They're disregarding the order of Guru." I don't know if the penalty is murder, but maybe it was then. If it is now, then we won't have too many disciples. No guru will have any disciples. It's disregarding or disobeying the order of the guru. The crime for that is murder in Kali Yuga. Then there'll be not too many disciples. Just be the guru and himself. And the guru will be his own disciple, I guess. The guru has to give teachings to himself and try to follow them. If he doesn't follow them, then he has to commit suicide. Guru Avagya, and then he gets suicide. They're saying Guru leaves some note, and they say, "Why did Gurudev commit suicide? And they find a note, and I'm very sorry, I was not able to carry out my instructions, so I committed suicide. So Jamadagni told Parasram, "I want you to kill your mother and your brothers for this reason. They're sinful." And then Parasram was a little bit, wasn't so inclined to do that, but he said, "Listen, if you give me a benediction, I'll kill them if you give me a benediction." "Yes, I'll give you a benediction. The benediction I want is that after I kill my mother and brothers, that you bring them back to life, and they forget that I killed them." They don't remember anything that I killed them. So the father said Bhavatu. Jamadagni said Icha Bhavatu. "May your desire be fulfilled." So he did it. And it happened. So this is a nice story how the lady, she sacrificed everything for Guru's pleasure. But she was saved. It was a happy ending. It looked like a tragedy at first. Didn't seem to make sense. In the service of Guru, Guru represents the highest principle of Dharma, religious code of ethics, morality, and purity. God amongst men. Guru Dev. Dev, Krishna's Dev. Kamadev, the Lord. Adi Dev, Krishna, then Guru Dev. And Guru Dev, somehow the disciple, has to become an adulteress or practically a prostitute to please the Guru. Seems very strange. Seems quite immoral and irreligious. But in the end, everything worked out fine. Very amazing story with a surprising twist. Sri Ramanujacharya ki. So this is some discussion about Guru, and Vyasadeva is glorified in Bhagavad Gita by Sanjay, and Krishna is speaking about Vyasadeva. In the 15th chapter of Gita, Krishna mentions Vyasadeva. Everyone knows that verse? Sarvasichaham, Riddhi Sannivishto, Matas Matirgyanam Apoanam Cha, Vidaishta Savaraham Eva Vidyo, Vedanta Kridveda Vedeva Cha. Krishna says to Arjuna, from me comes remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. By all the Vedas I am to be known. Indeed, I am the compiler of the Vedas and the knower as well. Vedanta Krit Veda Vedeva Cham. Vedanta Krit. Vedanta Krit means I am the knower. I know the end of the Vedas and I've compiled them. I've written down the Vedas. So how did he do that? He did that by empowering one rishi, Vedavyas. He became empowered with literary shakti or whatever, writing shakti or philosophy shakti, darshan shakti, Vedavyasa, shakti veshavatar of the Lord. It's sometimes described, Vedavyasa is the literary incarnation of the Lord. He has appeared to compile all the Vedas. He didn't necessarily speak all the Vedas, but he compiled them. Like we have, so many people may have dialogues and discussions, and someone sits there and writes everything down. So I think everyone knows the story. Vyasa was dictating and Ganesh was writing. Ganesh was his scribe, his secretary. But Ganesh, he likes to eat vadus. And if you eat vadus, then you have to kind of bathe and relieve yourself and stuff. So he was asking Vedavyasa, if you're going to speak all the time because you have a lot to say and a lot to write down, then when will I get a chance to eat some ladus and relieve myself? So he said, listen, you can get a break. And he also said, my hand's going to fall off from writing so much also. I need to break a little bit. So what did Vedavyas say? He said something, whenever I bathe and chant my anik, I think it was whenever I bathe and chant my anik, which is the tree sandhya vandanam, the chanting of my tree sandhya vandanam, my prayers at the three junctures of the day, morning, noon, and evening, then you can eat some ladus and do the needful and get a break, give your hand a break from writing. Before reciting the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the very means of conquest, one should offer respectful obeisances unto the personality of Godhead Narayan, Narayanam Namas Kritya, and offer obeisances unto Nara Narayan Rishi, the supermost human being, Naram Cheva Narottamam, and unto Mother Saraswati, Devi Saraswati, Vyas, the goddess of learning, and to Vyas, the author. This is Suta Goswami instructing the sages at Naimisharanya. So the Srila Vyasadeva, we're all indebted to him for giving us a Vedic literature. But especially we're indebted to him for giving us the Srimad Bhagavatam that Srila Prabhupada is so kindly translated in English, the world language, so that everyone in the world can be benefited by the sublime message of Bhagavan Sri Krishna and hear about the wonderful, pure loving service of the Bhajan Gopis. So this is that great auspicious appearance day of Srila Vyasadeva and all the spiritual masters, all of our different spiritual masters, our representatives of Srila Vyasadeva. And when they sit before the assembly of devotees, then the teachers of the Bhagavatam, they sit on one seat, one asana. And that asana is called Vyas Asana. It's an Indra Asana. Sometimes people, it's described in Puran that you can do these austerities and you'll attain Indra Asana, the seat of Indra, Swargamukti. It's So there's Indrasan, Singhasan, and Vyasasan. The Vyasasan is the seat of Vyas. It is the post of the Acharya, like the seat of the president. The seat stays there, but the president changes. The seat of the prime minister. The Vyasasan is always in the temple. But year after year, different teachers sit on the Vyasasan. So they're representing Vyas. Vyas is speaking through the speaker. Because the parampara is being represented there. Parampara is being honored on that seat. It's a raised seat in many temples. The Vyasasan is quite elevated. A very elaborate affair with an umbrella, with a chatri. There's a chatri over the speaker and over the book itself, and a raised place like in our Gopinath Mandir. You see there, there's
chatri
over the speaker. The speaker has he's sitting there and has a roof over his head, and then there's a raised area where the book is way above his feet. The book is about two, his feet are here, and the book is like this. This is pretty much the standard Vyasasan design, which I've seen in Vrindavan, Madhavan Temple, Govindji, Damodar, everywhere is pretty much like that. There's four posts, some canopy, chatri or canopy, then there's raised area for the book, quite raised, like this high, in front of the speaker. And there's the speed, it's just like this, there's the canopy. The book is way above, nowhere near the feet. 2 feet away from the feet. So it is the Paramahamsa Samhitam. It is a supreme of all supreme books. Not only is it Guru Granth, but it's Krishna Granth. Mm-hmm. It is Bhagavan Uvacha and Bhagavat Uvacha. It's devotee, pure devotees and gurus are speaking. Kapila is a guru. And Kumaras are gurus. And Prahlad is a guru. Yamaraj is a guru. Balir Vyasaki Vayam, the Mahajans are speaking. So our books should be so much revered and so much respected. So the traditional Vyasasans in the Gaudiya Sampradaya and the various ancient temples are quite high, and the book is held in a very high position. It's always wrapped with cloth. It's wrapped with some silk or jute cloth. Yeah, and you see in Radharaman temple how much regard they have to the ancient ways, and also Radhavallabha temple and Radharaman temple. Radharaman temple, the book is wrapped up and they change the cloth every so often like a deity. Very beautiful cloth and wrapped up and tied up and sitting very neatly on top of the Vyasasan. And people come every day, they do Prikama of Radharaman, and they go in the little side. There's a little Bhagavad Gar. There's a small room on the side of the temple. The deities are off the left shoulder of the speaker. And they face the audience from the side of the temple. It's called the Bhagavad Gar. It's a little room adjoining the temple room where they worship the Bhagavatam and Gita Singh, Vyasasan. And people do prikma there. They do prikma of the Vyasasan and pay obeisances to the Grantaraj. And as you said, they also fan the Grantaraj and they offer flowers and sweets and rice and kunkum and turmeric and water and tulsi and chandan and tulsi. That puja is done before speaking on the Bhagavatam. Because the Bhagavatam is Sakshat Radha and Sakshat Krishna. And of course the Sakshat form of all the great devotees. The Bhagavatam is especially Sakshat Krishna and Radha. So this Bhagavatam is as brilliant as the sun, has arisen after the departure of Lord Krishna to his own abode. And when Krishna went and left this world, he took dharma, religion and knowledge with him. The persons that are blinded by the effect of Kali, the dense ignorance in Kali has made people blind. They can get beautiful light from this Puran, light of knowledge, enlightenment. Krishna sada mo bhagate dharma gyanadi bhisaha kalo nashta drishamesha puranarko denodita. We have our Konark temple in near Puri. Arka means sun, and Puran Arka means sunlight. Puran, old book, Puran, full of light. Old, but old is gold, a golden, brilliant light. Puran Arka, Dunodita, Aduna, Udita, it's arisen. The Krishna sun appears to have set and left this world 5,000 years ago. But with the setting of the Krishna sun, there was the rising of the Bhagavat sun. The sun-like Purana arose from the mouths of Sutta Goswami and Shonaka and Shukadev. And so now this sun of the Bhagavatam is shining over the world like the sun planet in the daytime, illuminating the land and sky and seas with light. The sunlight Bhagavatam is illuminating the dark hearts of the Kali Yugites with the light of Godhead, the light of the Bhagavat, as Prabhupada said, the light of the Bhagavat. He has one book on
that.
Idam Bhagavatam Nama Puranam Brahma Samhitam Uttama Shloka Charitam Chakara Bhagavan Rishi Nishreya Lokasya Danyam Swastyanam Mahat. The Srimad Bhagavatam is a literary incarnation of God, and it is compiled by Srila Vyasadeva, the incarnation of God. Chakara Bhagavatam, Chakara Bhagavan Rishi. Right? Chakara is penned by Bhagavan Rishi. Bhagavan is a Rishi, Vyasa Rishi. And it has been presented for the ultimate good of all people. And this Srimad Bhagavatam is all successful, all blissful, and all perfect. Danyam Swastyanam Mahat is Swastyanam. Danyam, it is all successful, valuable, wealthy. Swastyanam, it is all blissful, auspicious, and Mahat, great, heavy, perfect. It is all successful, all blissful, and all perfect. Anyone who studies regularly the Srimad Bhagavatam, studies, remembers, and practices the teachings, becomes attached to the ras and purified by the tattvas, and he himself becomes successful, blissful, and perfect. This is the guarantee of the Bhagavatam. This is all the mercy of Vyasadeva. So we're very fortunate that we were able to receive the mercy of Srila Vyasadeva. By the mercy of his representative. The most famous representative of Srila Vyasadeva in the modern world is Srila Prabhupada. And everyone, somehow or other, has a connection with Srila Prabhupada. No matter what mission one finds himself in, who his guru is, what his path is, he knows something about Srila Prabhupada. He's heard about, he's read about, he's contacted, willfully or unwillfully, he's contacted Srila Prabhupada. But this is the mercy of Vyasadeva. Yesterday, he traveled outside of India, went to every country in the world and gave the message of Bhagavat. So we close our discussion and glorification of Vyas Purnima. Srila Veda Vyas Maharaj ki jai. Sri Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya ki jai. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki jai. His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Acharya Guru Parampara ki jai, Char Sampradaya ki jai, Gai Gaur Premanandi. All glories to assembled devotees. All glories to assembled devotees. All glories to assembled devotees. All glories, all glories, Sri Sri Guru Ramananda.